Good morning or afternoon, everyone, and welcome to emforum.org. I am Amy Sebring and will serve as your host and moderator today, and we are very glad you could join us. It is GIS Day today, you may not realize, so we think this program is very appropriate for that. For any first-timers, we will be providing some instructions as we go along so you can relax and participate with us. We do want you to participate in the discussion. If you need assistance, please select Help Desk from the drop-down options in either the Q&A panel or the chat panel, and our associate, Lori Weber, will try to assist you. Now, our topic today is the National Information Sharing Consortium. Our guest will provide an overview of this relatively new organization, and I am sure he will invite your organization to participate. Now, for the benefit of any first-timers, we will begin with an overview presentation and then proceed to your questions or comments. We will provide further instructions just before we begin the Q&A, but we ask you to hold off until that time. Today's recordings and a copy of the slides will be available from our site later on this afternoon, and then a transcript will be available early next week. Now, it is my pleasure to introduce Sean McSpadden, Membership and Outreach Coordinator for the Consortium, and he also served as its first chair. Sean currently also serves as Principal Legislative IT Analyst for the State of Oregon's Legislative Fiscal Office and previously served as the state's Deputy Chief Information Officer. Welcome, Sean. Thank you very much for being with us today, and I now turn the floor over to you to start us off, please.
All right. Amy, can you hear me?
Yes.
Great, great. Well, it's a pleasure to be with you all this morning, Pacific time, about noontime Eastern. As Amy indicated, my name is Sean McSpadden, and I've had quite a history in Oregon state government. 15 years working for the Department of Administrative Services. I served about 5.5 years as Oregon's Deputy State Chief Information Officer and now serve as a Principal Legislative Information Technology Analyst for the Oregon Legislative Fiscal Office. The consortium itself is an organization that's near and dear to my heart. I served as one of the 5 founding members and also as the consortium's first chair until August of this year. It's my pleasure to have the opportunity to give you an overview and an update of the consortium, and as Amy indicated, invite you all to participate on a more active basis in the future. So as the slide indicates, the National Information Sharing Consortium was formed in 2012 via a memorandum of agreement signed by the State of Oregon and our partners in the Commonwealth of Virginia, the State of California, the City of Charlottesville, Virginia, and the City of Charlotte, North Carolina. The memorandum of agreement is, at its heart, a voluntary reciprocal agreement to share items of value with one another, like governance documents, information sharing plans, standard operating procedures, and ultimately software code and documentation. But I want to reinforce that any sharing that occurs among and between the members is done, generally speaking, on a peer-to-peer basis and also is entirely voluntary. The consortium's mission is, generally speaking, to bring together a very diverse group of leaders involved in homeland security, public safety, and emergency management and response, and then to leverage the community's efforts related to the development, sharing, and governance of technology, data, and best practices. It's very important work that we're doing now across the nation to share the work that we have all funded with very scarce taxpayer dollars and resources. We found ourselves in June 2012 kind of struck by the realization that we were all beginning to or continuing to essentially pave the same set of road, you know, in various parts of the country. We were repeating one another's efforts. We weren't sharing in the way that we should, in particular when we were using taxpayer dollars and resources to get all of this work done. We've established now then a vision for the future that's primarily focused on enhancing situational awareness, information sharing, and resiliency capabilities in every community across the nation. And you'll see in the next few slides the kind of diversity that we have in our membership and in our board, and we believe that that makes this particular consortium a very unique organization among its peers across the country. As I mentioned, we place a great level of importance on diversity in membership. As you can see there, we've tried to attract folks from a variety of different domains. So, as an example, the International Association of Fire Chiefs is a member organization. The National Emergency Management Association is a member. Those particular organizations, along with various information technology and GIS associations, are focused on a singular domain. However, in this particular space, in emergency management and in homeland security matters, it will take professionals from each of these domains to actually get the job done at the end of the day. And so we've again, placed a great value on diversity, not only in regard to profession, but also geographic diversity and jurisdictional diversity, including some of our more recent counterparts across the border in Canada, and to include some international organizations and non-governmental organizations. Just to give you a little view into the growth that the consortium has experienced over time, as I mentioned, the organization was formed in June 2012. We started with five founding members. Fast forward roughly 9 months or so, we had grown to 24 organizations, including several national organizations and our first private industry partner, ESRI. From that point to present day, as of October 2013, we've now grown to 64 organizations. It includes several international associations and non-governmental organizations. Our reach now has extended beyond North America and is truly beginning to have an international feel. The 64 members represent 100-plus state and local government, civilian and military, now tribal government, academic and non-governmental and private industry partner organizations across the U.S. and Canada and now beyond. As with any organization, as Amy indicated, we're very young, in business a little more than a year, now a year and a half. With any organization, you can expect transitions. As Amy mentioned, I served as the organization's first chair. As my role in Oregon State government and in the community has changed, so has changed the leadership of the consortium. With our growth, the charter and bylaws of the consortium called for a growth in the board to make sure that we were representative of the entire set of community members that comprise the consortium. So we've moved since February 2013, an organization of about 24 or so members and six board members. Now, as of October 2013, we have 64 member organizations, and we're now represented and led by a 13-member board. I believe the two vacant positions have now received several nominations, and I would expect in the next month or so the consortium will have seated all of the board member seats. As I mentioned early on in the presentation, one of the core values of the consortium and the benefits of being a member of the consortium is gaining access to member and practitioner-developed resources. So we've begun to share a whole variety of items of value, including methods to gain access to the Department of Homeland Security, geospatial information infrastructures, HCIP Gold data, also the American Red Cross REST services. We're trying to make sure that we share methods of access to data. We're also sharing sample memorandums of agreement, intergovernmental agreements, and contract terms and conditions. And in this space, that becomes very, very important because, as I mentioned, when one jurisdiction hires a vendor or develops a particular item of value, like a GIS-enabled situational awareness viewer or a common operating picture, they need to ensure that they have contract terms and conditions that allow that work product to be shared. I'll get into in a few minutes how we've begun to share technology across the consortium. And a key part of that, believe it or not, is that we've had contract terms and conditions on purpose that allow us to share freely one governmental organization to another. A small detail, but very important. We've begun to share and conduct technology assessments, case studies, and presentations. As I mentioned, software code and documentation, lessons learned from our various programs and projects. Some of you on the call may be familiar with the Virtual USA pilot program that was sponsored by the Department of Homeland Security Science and Technology Directorate. Many of the founding members and subsequent members of the consortium participated in regional pilots since 2008, 2009. One of the other roles that I played here in Oregon in the Pacific Northwest was to serve as the chair of the technical working group for the Virtual USA Pacific Northwest pilot. And through those pilot programs, we learned a lot about information sharing, not only within our own community, with our own jurisdiction, but cross-jurisdictional, regional, and ultimately national information sharing, and the ability to visualize that data in common operating pictures that were jurisdiction-specific or shared, again, across a region or ultimately across the nation. We've also begun to launch a variety of initiative-focused working groups focused on Virtual USA transition, on the deployment of ArcGIS Online, and also a series of U.S.-Canada cross-border initiatives that will be conducted between now and 2017. I'll talk a little bit about some of these committees a little later in the presentation as well. So as I mentioned, the value of the consortium can be felt in many ways, including the sharing of software code and documentation between partners in a particular state, in a region, or across the country, and now internationally, certainly with cross-border sharing of not only data but also technology. I'll talk just very briefly about what you're seeing here on the slide. On the top row, from left to right, depicts a variety of widgets or micro-programs that the state of Oregon deployed as part of its viewer, which is called RAPTOR, the Real-Time Assessment and Planning Tool for Oregon. I see Keith Moen from Oregon Emergency Management is one of the attendees on this particular web conference. Keith is now responsible for RAPTOR deployment across Oregon. On the top row, you'll see a widget called the GeoPortal Find Data widget. Then moving to the right, something called the My Oregon widget. Those two widgets allow access to data within GeoPortal servers or particular, again, GeoPortals that are based on ESRI's ArcGIS GeoPortal server toolkit. The My Oregon widget allows for peer-to-peer information sharing utilizing REST services. Moving to the right, there's an area of concern tool that allows buffering the identification of critical infrastructure in vulnerable populations within a particular buffer area. Moving farther to the right on the top, something called the Oregon KPI or planning tool. On the bottom left is the Virtual USA My Library widget that allows a user to log in to the virtual library to access all of the content that is jurisdiction-specific, that's being shared by their partners, or that's been being shared as common data across the entire community. The bottom center is something called the Oregon Special Event Console. That was a widget shared to Oregon by the city of Charlotte, North Carolina. They utilized a very similar tool for their work in the Democratic National Convention that occurred in September of 2012. And then finally, the Raptor configuration tool. And this allows a user to establish special configurations of the viewer, either by event type, flood, fire, earthquake, tsunami, or by, as an example, by ESF, by emergency support function. The folks that are involved in each of the emergency support functions don't necessarily need to have access to all of the data or see all of the data that might exist or might be connected to the viewer at any one time. They're instead likely focused on emergency support function specific data that helps them do their job. So this slide just simply depicts how we've shared one of the tools, the My Organ widget, again, that allows peer-to-peer sharing of REST service data in a web map service format. On the top left, I show the original deployment within Oregon's Raptor viewer. We then shared that particular widget in the bottom left with the city of Charlottesville, Virginia, then on the top right, to the city of Charlotte, North Carolina, and then the bottom right with the Commonwealth of Virginia for deployment within the Situation Room viewer that they've deployed. As you can see, very similar look and feel. We shared something that Oregon developed with Oregon taxpayer dollars with jurisdictions across the country. And again, on the flip side, we've also been the beneficiary of technology that's been deployed in other jurisdictions. The top left, you'll see that Democratic National Convention events console that was deployed originally within the COBRA viewer, which is the city of Charlotte, North Carolina's situational awareness viewer. You can see it on the top right deployed within the Raptor viewer. And then the bottom left, I show the KPI tool, the planning tool that the city of Charlottesville, Virginia deployed within their CAVS viewer. And on the bottom right, I show how that was connected directly to the Raptor viewer. One of the things that enables this kind of information sharing is the deployment of a common viewer technology. And so it really doesn't matter, didn't matter to us as a consortium or didn't matter to us early on in the Virtual ESA program, which type of viewer it might be, whether it be open source or the Google Enterprise viewer. In this case, it just so happened that of the 35 or so original participants in the Virtual ESA program, 29 of them had deployed ESRI's ArcGIS viewer for Adobe Flex of one version or another. And the fact that we all deployed similar technology allowed this kind of sharing to occur on a very streamlined basis. In some cases, the connection and deployment of these widgets only took a half an hour or so. So just tremendous acceleration of the sharing of capabilities that are proven and tested in the field, which is also another important point. You're not simply deploying the next tool, the next cool gadget or widget that might come along. You actually have the benefit of another jurisdiction deploying their own environment, testing it out, ensuring from their perspective they believe it has value for the community, making others across the nation aware of these kinds of tools through the consortium, and then sharing the technology, sharing the knowledge, sharing the capability. That is how we're going to all get better at this very, very quickly. And then finally, I'll show the same kind of information sharing that occurred from Kentucky Emergency Management. Some of you may know Kentucky Emergency Management has deployed a variety of tools. One tool is called the MASS system, or Mutual Aid Support System, and a complementary technology that plugs into their viewer called CATS, the Mission Ready Package widget. This essentially was shared from Kentucky Emergency Management to a variety of folks, including the Canadian government, as part of an exercise called CAUSE that occurred in March of 2013. Bottom left, you can see the deployment of the Mission Ready package widget within the CAUSE viewer. It was also shared in a variety of formats, both as a web app and as an Esri ArcGIS viewer for Adobe Flex widget with the city of Charlottesville, Virginia, and also the Commonwealth of Virginia for deployment within the Governor's Situation Room. As I mentioned, we've not only shared software code and documentation, but we also shared methods of access to public and secure web map services. These two examples show how Oregon was able to connect to the Department of Homeland Security geospatial information infrastructure and the HCIP Gold REST services. We documented the methodology for accessing that data. We shared that method with other jurisdictions, and I think there's about a dozen to maybe 20 or so state and local government jurisdictions across the country that have now accessed that important resource. As some of you may know on the call, the previous method, the singular method for distribution of HCIP Gold data used to be the distribution of DVDs, and you could only utilize that information or access that information in times of a federally declared emergency or disaster. This method of access through REST services allows for persistent access over time for all facets of the emergency management continuum. And so essentially you have access to this important data in peacetime and in times of war, disaster, or during an active event. We also did the same thing in partnership with the American Red Cross. They've begun to expose more and more of their information, the national shelter system information, any of the locations of their assets across the U.S. And or the world. They provide access to that data in the same manner. As we've progressed, about a year after our foundation, we made a series of announcements. As I mentioned, most of the founding members and the early on members of the consortium had some level of involvement in the Virtual USA regional pilots that occurred from 2008 to 2013 or so. Importantly, we've maintained a very strong relationship with the Department of Homeland Security, Science and Technology, and in particular, Science and Technology Directorate, and in particular, the First Responders Group. We, in May 2013, struck a memorandum of agreement or a licensing agreement with the First Responders Group to take over or assume the user administration responsibility for the virtual library. We're now in the process of working with the 100 to 200 or so users of the virtual library that are located across the country at the federal, state, and local government level. We're in the process of evaluating a long-term go-forward strategy with the First Responders Group that is expected to be implemented by October of 2014. The second announcement that we made was in June 2013, just prior to the Esri International User Group meeting in San Diego. The announcement focused on the consortium's adoption of ArcGIS Online as a Virtual USA technology platform. And I say, and I emphasized that singular letter A, Virtual USA technology platform, because we recognize that there is no panacea. There is no silver bullet for information sharing in real or near real time across this entire very broad continuum of homeland security, public safety, and emergency management response. It's going to take multiple tools, and again, technology and data and information sharing are only one or two facets of a broader continuum of activity that needs to occur: governance, standard operating procedures, training and exercises, testing and usage are other focus areas of the consortium and others in the community that we need to pay attention to. And but that said, the adoption of ArcGIS Online as a virtual USA technology platform is very important for the consortium for a variety of reasons. The fact is at the federal, state, and local government level, jurisdictions across the country, in some cases in mass, have been adopting ArcGIS Online as an information sharing platform, both in the emergency management community, but also in government proper for human services, for economic development, for natural resources. And all of the data that's being shared in those communities is also very relevant to the emergency management public safety community. So we felt it was important that we had that same kind of information sharing mechanism. Will allow us to federate or tie together multiple ArcGIS Online portals, and we're in the process of doing that now. In part, we're testing out that theory or that capability through an upcoming exercise. It's occurring in the Central U.S. Earthquake Consortium region that's centered around the state of Kentucky or Commonwealth of Kentucky. In an exercise called the Capstone 2014 exercise. It will occur or complete in June 2014. We're working with 8 primary states and another 12 states that are surrounding the CUSIC region as part of that exercise, and we've deployed multiple ArcGIS Online portals for the partners' use in that exercise, and we plan to publish lessons learned sometime in the fall or winter of 2014. Importantly, another action that we've taken as a very young organization is the adoption of our first strategic plan. We did that in July 2013. As the slide indicates, we've got a variety of primary goals, again focused around situational awareness at the national level, the enhancement and standardization of information sharing capabilities, the support of the Emergency Management Assistance Compact and mutual aid efforts across the nation. And then, of course, as an organization, we've really got to focus on sustainability. It's oftentimes very easy to start something. We want to ensure that this is an organization that stands the test of time and that can be sustained for the long haul. And so we've got a great focus in that area. Very soon, I would say in the next month or so, the NISC board will adopt and post approximately an 18 to 24-month action plan, and that will further focus our efforts from the strategic to the tactical so that we stay on point in the next 18 months to 2 years. In regard to current activities, Virtual USA continues to be a primary focus area for the NISC. From our founding, the consortium has been supported by and we worked in partnership with the first responders group within DHS, as I mentioned, on a variety of topics, including governance and certainly the deployment of new technologies, including the Virtual USA ArcGIS Online portal. We're now beginning to work with our partners on at least a vision for the deployment of a public safety cloud computing environment, of which Virtual USA will be a part. Many of you on the call may be very familiar with or are beginning to become familiar with something called FirstNet. Sometime in the next 5 to 10 years, if all goes as planned, the entire community will have access to a high-speed public safety broadband network. That network is transport, is the ability to access things that are connected to the network, like situational awareness viewers, like geospatial libraries and geoportals, like a whole variety of other applications. And, you know, we need to get ahead of that. We need to make sure that partners from multiple jurisdictions can effectively and in a streamlined way access that public safety cloud computing environment and be able to obtain services or information from a variety of resources that might be located in any corner of the country. And so we've got a group of folks that are beginning to think about that, beginning to work with certainly our 64-member organization group, and more to come on that, but it will be a focus for the consortium for some time to come. In addition, we're working with the First Responders Group on a variety of incident management information sharing initiatives, including the establishment of an Incident Management Information Sharing Committee, which will serve as a subcommittee of the White House Information Sharing and Access Interagency Policy Committee. That's a mouthful, but suffice it to say, we're working with the White House Information Sharing Environment, the program manager, Sharmendra Paul. We're co-chairing a work group that is in the process of being formed with the Department of Homeland Security Science and Technology Directorate's First Responders Group. We'll be working on an IMIS capability and maturity model, and also we'll continue to expand our efforts in the areas of technology interoperability and in the establishment of a private industry advisory group. In addition to those activities, we continue to hold monthly webinars. Because of the federal government shutdown, we did not have an October webinar, but we were able to reschedule and hold a webinar on the GeoConOps, which is sponsored by the Department of Homeland Security CIO's office. That was held on November 14th. I believe in talking with Amy, the EM Forum has connected to those resources. Since September of 2012, we've held about a year's worth of monthly webinars, and certainly this group and emforum.org participants should have access to those resources. And again, we continue to focus on data and technology code sharing. As I mentioned a couple of times during the previous slides, we've begun to expand our efforts and strengthen our partnership with the Canadian government, both at the national and provincial level. In March of 2013, as I mentioned, there was an exercise that tested out interoperability and information sharing in real or near real time between a variety of resources in Canada and the Virtual USA library and other resources like IPAWS. That was a very successful endeavor. Certainly, if you'd like to find out more about these kinds of cross-border information sharing pilots, please visit the NISC website. I'll flash the URL or web address to that website in a slide or two. But we're working very closely with our partners, and we're very excited about the expansion of the consortium into Canada. So this is a recap slide on the consortium. Again, we're a 64-member organization at this point in time. We represent 100-plus state and local government, academic, non-governmental, and private industry partner organizations in the U.S. and Canada. We have a current focus on public safety, but as I alluded to during the presentation, what we're doing here in the area of homeland security, public safety, and emergency management and response, the lessons learned that we're gaining, the mechanisms for information sharing, I fundamentally believe can be applied to any area of government, and we need to pay attention to that and share beyond this community. In the top right, again, I just reiterate the kinds of information, the kinds of items of value that we're sharing with one another, and again, we're trying to grow our collective knowledge, our collective capability over time through partnership with one another, and the consortium's been a great vehicle for that. And so to one and all on the call and those who might have a chance to review the audio or the video of the web conference at a later time, I ask all of you to consider membership in the consortium. I really believe that we're stronger together than we ever could be on our own. I fundamentally believe we can accomplish much more together than we could ever dream of accomplishing in our individual jurisdiction. Again, we're all utilizing, or the majority of us are utilizing, scarce taxpayer dollars. We ought to leverage those dollars to the maximum extent, and I believe the consortium has been and will continue to be a great vehicle to do that. And that concludes my presentation, and I look forward to answering any questions that the group might have.
Thank you very much, Sean. That's really impressive in terms of how much you've managed to accomplish over the past year and a half or so. I think one of the first questions we will get from folks, though, is what does it cost to be a member? And for government organizations, that's no cost. Is that correct?
Yes, that's correct. On the consortium website, either now or very soon, you'll see a couple of items. One is a member guide, and the other is a sponsor guide. We've been very clear that we want to ensure there are, you know, as few as possible, if any, barriers for government organizations, you know, to join the consortium. And so at this point, we have a variety of member categories, federal, state, and local and international governments. There's no charge for non-governmental and academic organizations. There's no charge. There is a nominal fee for private industry partners, but very, very affordable in terms of entry. Again, the benefit to the private industry partners is that we plan to form a private industry council that will, we hope, will enhance the level of communication and access between our private industry partners and the balance of our membership.
Very good. Let's move on to our audience Q&A, if there's any. To ask a question or make a comment, please select host from the drop-down menu in the Q&A panel, then type in the area underneath. I'm going to go ahead and close the chat panel. I already had someone put a question in there, but I'll read it. No, I can't read it. Please re-enter your question in the Q&A panel. Then I will just read the questions out loud, and then our guests will respond by the bridge. Please keep your question or comment related to today's topic and reasonably concise. So we are ready to begin, and you may enter your comment or question at any time. And I will put the contact information back up here that we can be looking at or have available while we're doing the Q&A. And we have two or three questions already. R. Fuller, let's see, he says, I'm interested in working in critical infrastructure protection. How does a career corporate business continuity planner make the career jump with an information sharing organization? I think that one's a little off topic. Sorry about that. Let's go back to R. has a second question. He says, you have accomplished a lot. What are the top reasons organizations have reluctance joining as a partner? And there may not be any.
Well, I think that's
the obstacles, I guess.
Yeah, actually, Amy, I think that's a great question. And I would say, from my own perspective, there are a variety of reasons that, as I've talked to folks around the country over the last year, year and a half, that some of them have experienced some reluctance. First, we really are trying to ensure, first of all, members do join on behalf of their organization. And part of the reason that we've done that is to ensure continuity of membership. We want to make sure that, in particular, state and local government organizations are, you know, taking the lessons learned, taking the information that they gain or the items of value that they are able to exchange and receive through the consortium, they're applying it to their entire jurisdiction or at minimum to their own agency. And so, you know, oftentimes the folks who hear about the consortium may not be in a position where they can immediately sign on behalf of their organization. So that's one issue. Another that we've encountered really is the fact that this is a very young organization. We've only been in place for a year or a year and a half. So I think some folks have taken a wait-and-see approach. And the last, I think there are other reasons, but the last thing that I'd mention is that, as I alluded to in the presentation, I think that the consortium is very unique among its counterparts. We do not represent a singular profession. you know, folks who think about emergency management may naturally gravitate toward the National Emergency Management Association or the International Emergency Management or International Association of Emergency Managers, as an example. Or if they're in the IT space, they may gravitate toward the National Association of State Chief Information Officers, or in GIS, the National Association of Geographic Information Council, and so, or the National States Geographic Information Council. I'm sorry. And so, you know, on that point, folks need to hear about the consortium, need to see the kind of impact that we're having, and that takes some time. So a number of the members that have joined since February were on my initial contact list, and it just simply took some time for them to see that this was, you know, an organization that was going places, that was making an impact, and ultimately they saw that, got excited, and wanted to be part of what we're doing.
Terrific. One question from Cam Barnard, who asks, how do you, quote, radiate information among the consortium? That is, how do members of the consortium discover what others are doing?
So we do that through a variety of means. One of the primary areas is through these monthly webinars. We, for the most part, try to highlight and feature member work. And so if you look back at our webinars on the consortium website, we've had the state of Maryland talk about things that they're doing. We've had the Red Cross. We've had the Pacific Disaster Center. We've had the state of Oregon, the city of Charlottesville, Virginia. These are member-driven webinars. We typically have not had any vendors present information, although I believe that likely will change over time as we increase our focus on sponsorship. But that's one of the primary ways. Another way that we do it is through our participation in regional pilots. As an example, I mentioned the Capstone 2014 exercise. Many of the participants in Capstone 2014 are consortium members, and you know we're applying resources there. We're learning together, and ultimately we're going to leverage one another's work and produce a series of lessons learned documents and best practices out of that particular exercise. So those are two primary ways that we do it. And then the third is in participating with organizations like EM Forum and in presenting information at national events. You know, I've spoken multiple times to the National States Geographic Information Council. I've talked about the consortium even at the National Association of State CIOs, and also at the ESRI conference on multiple occasions. So we're trying to that's just my area of domain. As Amy indicated, I'm a former deputy state CIO for Oregon, and so I gravitate toward technology. Some of our other board of director members are emergency managers, are fire chiefs, and so they do the same kind of outreach in their own domain areas.
Do you have any meetings, for the members?
So the primary meeting that we've had, we do have a member summit. We held our first annual summit in July of 2013. As we're a very young organization, we've held off on face-to-face meetings, in part because our primary, the bulk of our members are state and local government, or we're trying to attract more federal government participants, and there's been in that space great difficulty in out-of-state travel. So we've tried to hold virtual meetings, but I think as we increase sponsorship, you'll see more and more face-to-face meetings over time. We do plan to hold at least a once-a-year face-to-face meeting, likely associated with another national conference.
Right. Good deal. I'm kind of glad he mentioned FirstNet, and it was funny. Just at that very moment, I was writing down to ask you about FirstNet. do you have any representation on their advisory, the FirstNet advisory group?
So we do not, but if you were to take a look at, the consortium is not a named member on the Public Safety Advisory Committee to FirstNet. However, if you look at the Public Safety Advisory Committee membership roster, a number of the folks who are named representatives are also consortium members.
Got it.
And so, in addition, most of the folks that belong to the consortium are not only experts or leaders in situational awareness and information sharing in the public safety and emergency management space, but they also have a day job responsibility at the state level or at the local government level for public safety wireless communications, and more so now in the planning for FirstNet in their jurisdictions. So we've got a lot of knowledge about this topic. We're doing outreach to APCO, APCO NENA on NextGen 911. We're doing a lot of outreach to FirstNet directly. Most of us have participated in the FirstNet regional working groups. And so I think there's a lot of crossover, but we haven't yet established a formal relationship between the consortium and FirstNet. But I think that will naturally come over time.
Sure. For newcomers, if you'd like to find out more information about FirstNet, we did do a program on it last spring sometime, and we do have that in our archives, and, of course, you can look it up. That's a very exciting area. Are you working or are members of your work, members of the consortium working in the area of mobile apps at all?
We are. You know, certainly a number of the folks, I would mention certainly Oregon with an application called iRaptor. We've created an iOS version of the Raptor Viewer in the city of Charlottesville, Virginia. There's a couple of iPhone and Android damage assessment tools. Oregon is also developing a damage assessment module for iRaptor. There are a variety of other tools across the country. So it's what I would point toward at this point in terms of awareness of mobile applications, I point to two sources. One, and this will be a little broader, not necessarily in the emergency management space only, but the National Association of State Chief Information Officers has created a mobile app catalog. In addition, in the public safety emergency management space, APCO has a mobile application catalog or library that they've been developing, and I know they've been working quite a bit with the FirstNet team on that. But several of our members have deployed those kinds of tools in their own jurisdiction, but it hasn't been a focus yet. They've been listing them through those other sources.
Yeah, and I had the understanding that was, you know, exactly the kind of thing that FirstNet will be looking for from their participants.
It will be, and really the challenge that everybody faces with mobile applications is connectivity, and is in terms of access to data, data caching. And, you know, the conversation begins to resemble, you know, a lot of the conversations that occur around radio caching for public safety wireless communications, you know, that, you know, and or, you know, equipment or supply caching in times of broad emergency.
Right.
The thing that these mobile applications need, unless you have all of the data, you know, either connected to or on the mobile device, is connectivity. And so, you know, unless and until high-speed broadband is deployed across all of our collective geographies, we're at a disadvantage with mobile apps, although a variety of jurisdictions are really trying to accelerate efforts in that area.
Good deal. I've got a couple more questions about membership. One from Isabel McCurdy, who happens to be a longtime EM Forum participants from British Columbia, and I imagine you've done some work up there with British Columbia. She asks, do you have to belong to an organization to become a member of the consortium? In other words, do you have any individual category?
So at this point, we do not have an individual category of membership. It is something that the board has been asked before and is considering, but at this point, yes, you do need to be associated with an organization that fits within one of the member categories. They're very broad. We do have some members that represent, as I said, non-governmental organizations. We have some that are associated with academic organizations, research institutes, and the like. But yes, at this point, as I said, members join on behalf of their organization, and we don't yet have an individual category.
Right. And one other question, George Davis asks, can non-U.S. companies be sponsors?
Yes. Okay. So, little, you know, at this point, we have two private industry partner members. One is called AppGeo, and the other is Esri. And Esri has a variety of, it has an interesting corporate model. So we do have representatives from Esri and Esri Canada. And so we, with our expansion into Canada and with our association with non-governmental organizations like NetHope, which is a consortium of humanitarian organizations across the world, yes, we don't pay attention necessarily to the origin of incorporation, but we would want to make sure that folks do meet the private industry partner member criteria.
Okay. A question from Alan Rourke, who asks, Sean, will you be at the International Disaster Conference and Expo in New Orleans in January 7th and 10th?
So I will not. It is possible that some of our board members who are also involved in emergency management, public safety may attend, but at this point I will not be attending that expo. But I'd be glad to, you know, certainly if, Alan, you want to contact me, offline, I'd be glad to talk with you about the conferences that we do plan to attend and at minimum what information we might be able to provide you or other colleagues who will be attending that disaster conference.
Speaking of outreach, Sean, are you planning to do a newsletter of any type, or do you already do a newsletter?
We've had some fits and starts with that.
Okay.
In part, we've had a focus on our website itself. But, yes, we do send out a newsletter to our member organizations and a broader set of stakeholders. And early on, the first 6 to 9 months of the organization, we sent out a monthly newsletter. We began to post more and more of that information online. And so I think you'll see the distribution of a URL or web address in the future as opposed to a direct distribution of a file. But, yeah, we are focused on that. And if you have questions about that, please send us an email at either – you know, my email address or the info@nisconsortium.org.
Okay. Very good. I've got a question from Mark Andrus, and he says, have you considered partnerships with state school safety centers? I am the Information Services Associate Director for the Texas School Safety Center, and we are working very hard to implement this type of public safety information sharing with schools.
Well, I would say the quick answer to the question is, no, we haven't yet established those kinds of relationships, but on the flip side, we're very interested in that topic. One of our members in Alabama, the folks that maintain and support Virtual Alabama, have had a very strong school safety initiative. I'd be glad to connect you with them if you haven't already begun to talk with them about the approach that they've taken, and we do plan in either later this year or early next to have a variety of webinars, both with Alabama but also our partners at Department of Homeland Security on this very topic. So, Mark, I'd encourage you to contact me and would be glad to share any formal information back with EM Forum for posting on the site.
Great. And it sounds like his organization might would fit in your membership category, would it not?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah. We're coming to the end. It's just about time to wrap up. I don't have any more questions in the queue, but I did want to ask you one more thing. Is the consortium or, let's say, members of the consortium starting to get involved in, you know, the cybersecurity response planning type of things at all?
Short answer is yes.
Mm-hmm.
As I mentioned, the members themselves are not only involved in situational awareness, information sharing, and public safety wireless communications, but a number of them are involved in a variety of cyber exercises that typically are coordinated through the state emergency management organizations in partnership with the Department of Homeland Security. There are, for the last 5 or 6 years, have been exercises called Cyber Storm exercises that have occurred, and really they focus on cyber attacks to critical infrastructure and, you know, the impact that is felt across a variety of industry sectors. I think more so we're going to have a more focused involvement in the future as conversations around FirstNet, as conversations around the deployment of multiple public safety cloud computing environments occur. And because the critical piece in being able to access data, information, and applications that may not reside within your own data center is identity management and federated access. Certainly the federal government has had quite a long history of involvement in this area. They're trying to tackle it through the connection of Homeland Security and public safety related applications to the Homeland Security Information Network. There are organizations like the Georgia Tech Research Institute that are working with DHS and with the National Association of State Chief Information Officers on something called the National Identity Exchange Framework. Mm-hmm. And I encourage you to find out more about that. Certainly if you have questions about, for short, the acronym is NIEF, N-I-E-F. I'd be glad to share information about it. But really it centers on a public safety or emergency management professional being able to enter a common credential that enables them to have access to multiple resources that might be housed and maintained basically anywhere. and so anywhere connected to the public safety broadband network. And so, you know, if we don't collectively solve this issue, we're going to be back to, you know, having 15, 20, 30 passwords, or if you use the PIV I cards, an entire stack of PIV I cards that you have to use to access, you know, one resource at a time.
And I did have one last, and we'll wrap it up on this one. Are you, the consortium or members of the consortium that you're aware of, working in the area of that mining social data, especially for geospatial information?
Yes. Certainly, if you take a look across the country, state, local government, and federal government organizations are utilizing social media not only for push communications but also for pull communications. And the challenge that we're all facing really is in filtering that data, making sure that we have some way of analyzing it to understand whether it's of value for the particular event. I think you see more and more encouragement of the use of social media tools, and also on the flip side, more and more of our situational awareness viewers are at least displaying, enabling the ability to display Twitter, Flickr, Facebook posts that relate to particular events that are occurring across the country. So it's a dramatic area of expansion. I think you'll see more and more of the technology companies, Esri, Google, and the like, that are enabling their customers to, as I said, not only visualize that data, but also make sense of it.
Right. That's a big part of it. Okay, let's go ahead and wrap it up for today. On behalf of Ava Jean, myself, and all our participants today, Sean, thank you so much for being with us and sharing this information. And we hope the consortium will continue to grow and serve our community in the future.
Thank you very much for the opportunity.
Folks, before you go, please do take a moment to give us a little bit of feedback. And we are also pleased to welcome a new EIP partner today, Priory Health Partners, LLC, represented by Nick Newdell. Please look them up on our partners list, and also you can find further information about partnership on our site. Our next and final program for this year will be December 11th, when we will be learning about another exciting organization, the Safe America Foundation. Please note, if you are not on our mailing list, you can subscribe from our home page, and you will get our future announcements. Thanks to everyone for participating today, and until next time, have a very safe and happy Thanksgiving holiday to all of you. We are adjourned. Bye now.